All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking more Survivor Winners at War Week 2. I'm going to tentatively call it. Dom, how are you doing this week?
Very nice. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm off to a strong start diplomacy-wise, I would say. I know it's a hot debate. Is this episode 2 or episode 3? Where do you come down on that?
I would say it's episode 3. I believe that officially is what it's meant to be. I know other people would say episode 2. So we are taking a powerfully centrist stance and going with week 2, just to keep everyone somewhat satisfied, but also a little bit resentful at us as well.
Well, here's the thing. We will not be going with week 2 when it comes to the episode title for this podcast. And unfortunately, this is now the second week in a row where the word on the street that you have heard is different than the word on the street that I have heard. I feel like it has been commonly referred to as episode 2, if not like conclusively confirmed. I feel like I've heard it in a pretty official capacity to be episode 2, and I'm go ahead, sorry.
First of all, nobody is commonly referring to this as anything. No one cares what, you know, whether it's episode 2, episode 3, week 2, week 3. Also, why aren't we doing that? What, isn't this the perfect opportunity to avoid this ambiguity permanently for however long we keep doing this and just switch to a much better system?
Given that we are 8.5 years into a format that has never deviated once for our weekly Survivor episodes, I am going to stick with that. And I am looking on Wikipedia. Wikipedia has it listed as episode 2. I am making an executive decision here, Dom. I don't care at all about what word on the street is or isn't happening or what you've heard. This is episode 2, as far as I am concerned. And sorry.
This is an excellent showcase for how hard it is to get even the smallest institutional change through the powers that be. in case that has any larger message for society at any point this year. But in any case, no one cares about that. Let's move on to something that hopefully people out there do care about, which is the episode of Survivor, whichever number may or may not be attached to it. So we are going to get, or the episode rather, is going to get right into the action, unlike us. We open here on Edge of Extinction, where Natalie is really, I mean, she's not doing great in the game, but she is doing great, sweetie, in our confessional draft, where my pick of Natalie is looking fantastic at this point. She's really hocking up all the screen time here.
Yeah, it's crazy. Natalie, I don't have the exact count in front of me, but she is running away with the confessional lead on this season. And not only in the context of confessionals does it seem good to be one of the early people on Edge of Extinction, but another thing that I've seen flagged up in many places over the course of these last few days is, assuming it continues to be this way, where it appears that when you are voted out of the game, you must will all of your fire tokens to someone, and you are thus kind of reset to zero when you show up on Edge of Extinction. It seems like, along with getting a lot of confessionals, it's also a pretty big edge to, pardon the Edge of Extinction pun, it's a pretty big advantage to be there early, so you have as much time as possible to rack up all of these fire tokens with which you can buy idols and advantages in these return challenges.
Yeah, for sure. And I wonder if the people in the game are really cognizant of that. Like, none of them know how this new Survivor economy really works yet, and the people on the edge are just figuring it out for themselves. So obviously, you don't want to be voted out, but let's say you knew with certainty that you were going to get voted out before this first round of Edge of Extinction comes to an end. I think you would want to be sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah, I would, you know, if it has to be one of those two things, it seems like, yeah, you would want to maximize the amount of time you can have to get however many advantages you can. I think there's a cap on it, but certainly you want to be in the mix there instead of going in the day before the re-entry challenge completely cold.
I wonder how much that feeds into this perception of Rob and Amber as a threat, because you would think, and Rob I think would agree with this, even though he's obviously sad and upset that it had to come to this, the fact that Amber has been voted out should really minimize Rob's threat level insofar as that's even possible. But if you think that the people on edge are still going to have a decent amount of influence, and the earlier they get there, the more influence they have, then maybe the idea of Amber just spiking the challenge or coming back in, or at least doing, you know, working her magic while she's there, that still seems like a real possibility and something you have to account for.
Not only the threat of Amber re-entering, but now that people, as Jeremy will get into when he is given his advantage this episode, and as Sandra, I think, alluded to last week when she found a random idol in her bag, the information is going to get out there that on a pretty, you know, at least based on these first couple episodes, I'm guessing this is going to be a pretty regular basis. Advantages are going to be entering the main game from Edge of Extinction. And if anything, I would almost rather have Rob and Amber just on separate tribes in the main game than have one of them constantly funneling as many advantages, at least that they can get their hands on, to the other person.
Yeah, if you had your druthers, I think you would rather keep them on separate tribes until the last possible moment and right. then vote either one of them out or then back-to-back sequentially just to make sure that they can't keep, like, sending stuff to each other through this pipeline between the main game and Edge of Extinction. But I also wonder with Natalie at the moment has Edge of Extinction basically to herself, and I'm sure Amber will get a little bit of content too, but Natalie for now is the biggest personality on Edge of Extinction. And that's not really going to change now that Danny's there too. But so for the meantime, Natalie is going to be maybe the main narrator over there and get a lot of the screen time. I'm curious what's going to happen as Edge of Extinction has 6 or 7 or 8 people on it, and we get to the point where, like, it's so crowded that this one segment every week can't possibly do justice to everyone who's there. Like, if let's say Natalie does complete the prophecy and come back in, are they just going to give her some kind of sustained focus throughout, or will she have to fight for the scraps of airtime with, you know, the sixth boot who we don't even know in 3 weeks from now?
I think a lot of it in terms of how they edit Edge of Extinction will come down to how it ultimately plays out. And I know they took a great deal of care with, like, the Chris Underwood edit and not wanting to make it obvious. In a season with all winners and all characters that we know and generally love from their first, second, or third, or in Boston Rob case, fourth time around, it's really going to be difficult for me to be inclined to draw any kind of big conclusions based on the Edge of Extinction edit. But one thing I thought that I'm hopefully going to be wrong about just regarding the Edge of Extinction edit is hopefully it picks up for her, but I can already kind of feel myself feeling about Amber the same way I do about Candace or Tina Wesson, where I legit forgot that they came back for a third time. Like, I have to actively trigger my memory to acknowledge that they are three-time players instead of two-time players. And I am nervous that I can already feel myself years from now forgetting that Amber was ever even a contestant on this season. And I don't want that. I spent a lot of money on Amber in our auction draft. I was rooting hard for Amber coming into this, but I am very nervous that she is pretty much only going to be in the story as things pertain to being Boston Rob's wife.
I would worry even more about that for Danny, who does not have the convenient story hook of being Boston Rob's wife yet, at least. I mean, maybe that's going to be the big twist of this season. But for a lot of these early boots, they could just fade into obscurity. And even though this Edge of Extinction twist is specifically designed and implemented here to make sure that they still have their day in the sun, that if, you know, what one of the big hitters goes out early, that they're still going to be around for the season, you can milk a little more content out of them. That is going to be a concern that for many people on this cast, this season will be a footnote in their Survivor story, which is, you know, if you're a fan of those people, is a bad thing to think about. But
I agree. I agree to just quickly close on that. I agree that Danny is a much bigger candidate to just go completely invisible, a much better candidate, I guess, to go more or less invisible from this point forward, and I will not have as many lasting memories of Danny when I think back and remember that she was on this season. But I would say that will be a situation to me, kind of like, this is a weird comparison, but it's the first one that came to mind, where I'll never forget that Sugar or Randy Bailey did return and came back. The same way I will for sure remember that Danny out of nowhere came back to Survivor 15 years later.
Okay, I could see that, but let's move on from this and talk about the real meat of the episode here, because after our obligatory Edge of Extinction segment, for the week. We're going to get back to Rob, who is receiving a token from Edge of Extinction, and he's not happy about it because he knows... he doesn't know exactly what this means. He does. He's kind of like desperately casting around for possibilities for what it could be instead, but he knows what this is overwhelmingly likely to mean. And sure enough, he's going to get to the translator and find that Amber's gone. And he keeps his composure in the moment, but you can tell that he's torn up about it. And that, just to jump ahead to that challenge in the immediate aftermath of him learning that is the first time that I've ever really seen Boston Rob rattled. And that fed through into his trance performance, I think, too.
I buy that it was some sort of effect on his mentality entering the challenge, although we did see that when he just opened the package and received the fire token, right away he understood this is very likely going to be bad news, and the fact that he didn't seem to have a ton to say to Jeff about Amber being gone indicated to me that he was pretty prepared for that being a likely outcome. And I agree that it is definitely not going to be the case that he can go from getting that confirmation to, you know, letting it roll off his back and go on to perform as he otherwise would in the challenge. At the same time, it did seem like Boston Rob's failure in this challenge just came down to something I was actually surprised didn't work out that well. I've always been a pretty big advocate for when it's possible and when it makes sense, do the puzzle in the sand or stack it off the board, because it's so much easier to move around that way. And then once you've got it, put it up on the official placement spot or whatever. But overall, I did not buy that Rob just being rattled by this news of Amber leaving is the reason that he lost this puzzle. It seemed to me to come down to just a fundamentally bad approach.
Yeah, it's more of a sportscaster narrative where,
yes,
of course, you have to tie the loss to some big emotional event that preceded it and weave that all together. But in reality, maybe Rob just had a bad day at the puzzle, at the challenge, right? Like, sometimes that happens. And in Boston Rob's defense, it very rarely happens to him. And we've seen him play effectively like two full seasons and then two half seasons worth of challenges, and he's been a very consistent performer, maybe the most consistent performer across all of that time going back over 15 years. So for him to have one bad day, you'll let him have that, right?
No question. I would never try to take anything away from Boston Rob in the challenges in general. I think he is absolutely someone that you would always want on your team leading the way, for sure.
You're not Ethan saying, dude, you suck. You know, you're keeping it nice. But
I have no expectation that like Rob is washed now in challenges. I expect him the next opportunity to go out there and still be good at it.
Right. But that's, I think, why it's easy to latch onto that narrative. And you know that Jeff's going to make a lot out of it, too, where once you've seen Rob just do so well so often, it's almost a compliment to him that you would attribute this to him being thrown by this once in a lifetime event, which, you know, if you said to Rob on his first season, okay, one day you're going to come back and the fact that your wife has been voted out is going to cause you to flub a challenge, there are so many aspects of that sentence that would just seem conceptually impossible, right? And you know, before Blood versus Water, we were saying that like just the idea of someone, you know, we see people at the family visit every season break down just getting a glimpse of their loved one after so many days, and just playing Survivor with them is such a weird experience that nobody who hasn't done it is going to be able to relate to, even if they play Survivor several times themselves. And now Rob comes in here as the biggest target, in part because of that relationship, and he is the only one on the season who can experience that in Winners at War, right? Because on a Blood versus Water season, you accept this as part of what you sign up for, that there is a chance every challenge you're going to get there and your loved one will be gone. And you will have seen this happen to other people on your tribe already, and you've seen them struggling to process that, and you have to think about how you'd react yourself. Rob is the only one who has to worry about that, so no one else can even really empathize, I suppose.
Amber could.
Okay, yes, Amber could, and I guess like Tyson and the late Natalie Anderson could too. But you see what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, if it takes something of this caliber to throw Rob off his game, then that's a compliment to him in a way. But coming back to this now, After this, the first real scene of camp life that we're going to see is Ben just, whether out of boredom or out of, you know, trying to find a new ally in the game, he decides to teach Denise about how to find an idol. And whether it's because of his expert tutelage or just because it's very easy to find because it's just hidden in a log, as always, Denise goes and finds it. But there's a twist this season, Colin, and the twist is that it's not just a normal immunity idol. It is an idol in two halves, and you have to give your half to one other person on your tribe before sundown. And in order to use the idol as the rules have it drawn up, both of you need to agree on how you're going to use it. So Ben helps Denise to find it, and so now he's suddenly in an interesting spot where you might expect there to be like this quid pro quo of, well, I helped you find it, so maybe you should consider entertaining the idea of giving me the idol. But he doesn't want to come off too strong, and he knows that he doesn't have a close enough bond with Denise yet that she would be fully comfortable doing that. Whereas if he can displace that and say, well, hey, just yeah, give it to Adam, give it to someone else, then that almost is a greater way of building trust than trying to like cement that by force with the idol.
Absolutely no doubt about it. Last week we talked about Ben a couple of times jokingly, or so I thought, in the context of we are now a pro Ben Driebergen podcast this season. This week, I am unironically coming in here preaching the gospel of Ben Driebergen and doing really good stuff. I thought this was really impressive, frankly, from front to back here. You know, plenty to be desired about his performance last week, but he seemed to me to understand, okay, I know that I am not going to be one of the more experienced players when it comes to understanding the social game. That wasn't my strength the first time around. I'm going to take whatever my strength was and try to use that to my benefit to build bonds. I really didn't think, you know, teaching people how to find idols would be something that would necessarily be that compelling as like a selling point. But job really well done here by Ben. And in particular, when Denise finds that idol, it really seems like his immediate reaction is, do whatever you want. I think it would be smart to use it to bring someone else in too. Just let me know what you end up thinking is the best plan. I truly loved what I saw out of Ben this week, and maybe I said that during some of the early weeks of Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, but I really did not anticipate ever coming in here and saying that. But yeah, were you on roughly that same page, or am I just seeing what I want to see now that I'm a pro Ben Driebergen podcaster?
So I wouldn't want to take away your fave from you. I do wonder what the reception is going to be for Ben if he makes a deep run in the season, because we've seen Rob and Parvati now take almost rejoice in dunking on Ben in public whenever they get the chance to. And we saw it this episode too, where at Tribal, Ben is tongue-tied in Rob's presence once again, and Rob enjoys just like needling him and giving him some rope to hang himself with. And there's this, certainly among, you know, Rob and Parvati, but maybe among some of the other cast members too, there's almost like this disdain for Ben. And I don't know how much of that is tied to what he's actually like to live with or to play the game with versus just the idea that him being there at all is undeserving. And you see this a lot on social media too, where every single like official CBS Survivor post about Ben, or every clip of Ben, or just any mention of Ben is drowned out by people just talking shit about him, saying he doesn't deserve to be there, and so on and so forth. I don't know how Malta's going to get under any one of their skins, if you like. But like, okay, they've won $1 million before. They're going to cry themselves to sleep on their giant pile of money or whatever. but for Ben, I think he does feel a sense of like, I know I'm seen as like this you know, junior varsity member who somehow snuck into the All-Star game, and no one thinks I deserve to be there. And Rob is going to remind me of that fact every opportunity I get. And so I wonder how that's going to inform his gameplay later on. But maybe he thinks he just needs to like go balls to the wall aggressive and make some really flashy moves, because otherwise no one's going to take him seriously, even if he does make it to the end a second time.
I could certainly see that being the case. And I would you know, in a situation where Ben is in there deep in the end game, be on board with that. I don't think that would necessarily be an incorrect viewpoint from which to operate here from Ben. I really don't think that the meta considerations for, you know, how winners feel about other winners play a huge deal on like a day-to-day basis out there. But I actually do believe in specifically the case of Ben Dreeberg, and because of the way he won the game, he is going to feel like he has something to prove out there, and that could absolutely be an accurate kind of read on his part, that he is playing at least initially a disadvantage because he doesn't have the same degree of respect that pretty much everyone else out there, I would imagine, has for anyone else who could win the game in like a conventional way.
Yeah, and I totally get the people who are frustrated by Ben's presence on the season, just with all the circumstances surrounding his win in the first place. For me, I'm trying to get into the mindset of like, okay, now that he's here, I'm going to wipe that slate clean and just take him at face value on the season and hope he does a good job and see if he can impress on this bigger stage, even if you think he shouldn't be there in the first place. And I won't say so far so good, because it was a pretty rocky start last week, but maybe this is the kind of thing where he can rebound effectively from that and like grow into his role. And by the end, I may also unironically be a pro Ben fan account. We'll stay tuned on that front.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate what really stood out to me was how good the impulse was in the heat of the moment. Denise has just picked up the idol. You have no time to think about how you want to continue from here. It's not like you could anticipate that this was going to be a half idle situation. And I thought he showed some really good instinct there to make it clear to Denise, hey, this is yours. Do whatever you want. I think it could be really smart to use this to bring someone else in. You definitely do not have to feel any kind of obligation to give it to me. I think that is a spot that a lot of people could get wrong there. And let's get into Denise's ideas here with the other half of this idol. We've seen Denise and Adam get off to a really strong start here. They seem like a duo to keep an eye on going forward. And she goes and tells him, hey, great news, I just found an idol. Unfortunately, Ben was right there with me, but what do we want to do about this? Because I have to give half of it to someone, and I was thinking of giving it to Parvati. And Adam is pretty straightforward, it seems like, with her here, saying just straight to her face, I think that is a terrible idea, which in Adam's defense is probably true, but this is, it's so weird to go from a segment complimenting Ben for his amazing impulses to questioning one of my favorite players and one of the people I had the highest expectations for here in Adam. While he is totally right that giving it to Parvati would be insane, maybe be a little easier with breaking that news to Denise.
I don't think it's totally insane, or at least I see where it's coming from, because it's easy to look at that and it seems like it's coming completely out of the blue. Like, we haven't seen Denise and Parvati talk at all yet, so maybe it seems like she's just trying to like suck up to Parvati, or she thinks that she's really on the out. So if she can show that trust and loyalty to someone at the top, they can use their influence to keep them safe or something like that. It turns out that Denise and Parvati had a pretty early alliance too. And in Denise's mind, that was something that she really thought she could go deep in the game with. And Parvati could be her ride or die. And this was before the Rob and Parvati thing really came into the picture. And so when she got the two halves of that idol, she saw this as an opportunity to like unify her two closest alliance members under the same banner, where she has Adam on one arm, Parvati on the other. What if we bring them together and I can like have it all, right?
Right.
That requires, though, that the people who you're like holding under your arms aren't like fighting with each other the whole time, which I think would be true of Adam and Parvati. I don't think they trust each other, have each other in each other's plans at all, or really see a bright future with the other one still in the game.
I think they could. So, I think if it made sense, they would both be very willing to work together.
Yeah,
but there's no chance they're going to actually trust each other.
Yeah, I think that they would be willing to do it. Both of them have that ability to just like play nice for the time being if they need to. But I think it would take all the people they trust more being voted out for them to want to come together. And if you're the person who is trying to be the unifier, that's a tough spot to be in. So I see why she wanted to do that, but it looks so bad for her if she doesn't run it by Adam. And of course, when she runs it by Adam, he's going to say, hey, I have an idea. Give it to Adam. Don't give it to Parvati. So,
I would return to the theme of just like amazingly great survivor impulses. I wanted to say about Denise here, as soon as Adam says, I think that would be a terrible idea, Denise cannot quickly enough start nodding and saying, oh, yep, you're right. Nope, that would be very stupid. I'm super interested in what you want to do here. She doesn't fight back at all.
She doesn't dig her hole even deeper. I would say calling it an amazing survivor impulse is, maybe it's just a convenient segue, but that feels a little over the line to me. Like, it's clearly the right thing to do, but I think this might be a case of, like, our impressions of someone from their previous season just overwhelming what they're actually doing on this one. Because someone said last week that he felt that we were giving way too much credit to Kim for not digging her grave so deep that it collapsed in on her. But that's hardly like fulsome praise to give to someone that we were hailing previously as the best of all time. And if you just look at her actions on the episode, there was nothing to suggest that she would even be that mix if you didn't know her from Oneworld.
The reason I do not feel it is hyperbolic to call this an amazingly great survivor impulse. To me, this is exactly what makes Denise Stapley so good, is she goes to Adam with this idea, and 2 seconds later, he has rejected it as flatly as is possible, and she is doing a complete 180, saying, okay, now I immediately recognize where Adam is coming from, and I am on that page too. Whatever Adam wants from me right now, I am giving it to him.
And I think any half-decent player would have the same impulse.
Come
and
on.
Maybe they would not have the same therapeutic manner that Denise has, but to act like this is some like revolutionary survivor idea for Denise is just like, I am also a Denise Stan account, and to the extent that I am muscling in on your territory there. However, I think you have to take the blinders off sometimes and just see it for what it is.
I this to me really stood out in this episode is that exchange of Adam saying, I think this is a terrible idea, and Denise just immediately being on board with that. That was one of the most impressive things to me this week. But I wanted to flag up.
No, but that is also almost any conversation between Alliance members whenever they disagree on anything. Right?
It's like, not, though. What we're doing right now, they go back and forth for a little while. If Denise were on this podcast, she would have agreed with you as soon as you made one counterpoint.
But that's just because you're obstreperous and never agree with me on anything. Whereas Adam and Denise, you know, like, we're going to see so many conversations this season between two Alliance members who have the same shared agenda, they're on the same team, but they disagree about what the right move should be for this round. And you're going to see them hash that out and come to a conclusion, and maybe one of them is not going to be really happy about it because they wanted to do something else, but they'll agree to it because that's what you do. That's what you have to do for any alliance to work properly. And so to act like Denise invented the alliance and the wheel and you know, everything else under the sun is just, it seems preposterous to me.
Okay. I just learned a new word, by the way, which I had to Google, but I have found: obstreperous, adjective, noisy and difficult to control. I can't say I disagree. I think that is fair. But I wanted to also...
Oh, wow, Colin, you can't say you disagree with me? That's amazing. How do you do that? How are you so good with people?
All right, I get it. All right. But I wanted to say about Denise and Adam while we're on it. It occurred to me that when we came in here, I don't remember when it was. It was like March, April, May, somewhere in there. It was before the Edge of Extinction finale had even aired. It was like merge time in Edge of Extinction. The season 40 cast was not even finalized yet. We were just made aware that it did look like All Winners was officially going to be a thing for season 40. You and I got together, Dom, and did 3.5 hours worth of drafting of every person who had ever won Survivor. 38 winners on the board with the top two picks. You took Denise and I took Adam. Now we can set aside the fact that the 3, 4, and 5 picks were Natalie Anderson, Danny Boatwright, and Earl Cole, who was not on this season. But these are the top two picks in our all-time draft. And it would be pretty incredible as far as I'm concerned if we just nailed that and could just shut it down after that.
That is it reminds me of our streak for like three seasons in a row of the winner would go with like the 19th pick or something. And I think if like Rodney had won Worlds Apart, which he claimed perilously close to doing, that actually would have been a streak. So
yeah.
Just listen to what we say and do the exact opposite, and you won't be led astray.
Well, no, I think listen to that podcast, but then shut it off after about 20 minutes because it's never going to get any better from there. But I am a big fan of this Denise and Adam duo, and even without our draft going that way, and I know everyone cares deeply about that draft, so that's why I bring it up. But even without that, I would certainly be rooting extremely hard for just the concept of these two coming together. But it looks like so far, so good on that front. One other thing, Dom, just before we move on to whatever is coming next, I want to quickly go back to something we skipped over. We don't have to spend a ton of time on this, but when Rob was talking about getting that fire token and kind of coming to terms with the idea that it looks like Amber is probably going to be the person who is not going to be there at this next challenge. He did say a couple of times, maybe it was Sandra who got voted out and left me with this fire token. I did think it was worth going back and quickly just getting your thoughts on that. Is that, how does that read to you? Because it seems like the episode has made it clear Sandra is overtly against you, Rob.
Yeah, and they seem to think that Sandra was against them coming in. So yeah, I it would be weird if Rob genuinely thought that, but I think this was, as I flagged up before, just him like he knows what this is and he just desperately wants it to be something else, and so I guess this is at the top of that list, as short as it may be.
Yeah, if maybe it was Sandra is the best you can convince yourself of, be pretty ready to not see your wife at that next challenge. But I suspect he was. So sorry, but I thought that was worth going back to just quickly.
Meanwhile, the actual greatest of all time, Kim Spradlin, again, not that you know that from watching the season so far, but she, through a combination of God's grace, good vibes, superstition, whatever the actual mix is, she finds the idol on the other camp, and she now has to decide who to give her half of it to. And for Kim, she's in a spot where the first episode saw her and her closest ally as the two targets of a split vote. So she really feels like she's on the outs now. So she now has to think, like, do I give it to maybe the one or two people that I do trust in the game? Or do I try and use it to cement this side deal with someone who is in control and can use the influence that they do have to keep me safe? And she kind of goes for both at once, it seems, by giving it to Sophie, who seems very surprised by this and is like calling Kim out for her poor gameplay in giving it to her in the first place, which also surprised me because I didn't think that made any sense for Sophie either.
Didn't make sense for Sophie in what respect? Because I think what Sophie was saying was not necessarily that she was going to betray Kim immediately, but just that she didn't understand why Kim would necessarily feel enough trust to share this with her instead of Tyson.
I don't know. It seemed it's weird to say that you know more than someone who is out there playing the game.
Oh, and I have no problem saying that. I know way more than any of these people out there.
And that is the premise of podcasting about Survivor. So, you know, that's what you signed up for if you're listening to this. But I think in this case, it actually kind of like strengthens the argument where even as someone who does not have Sophie's perspective on how the game works in general, and who also is not out there getting the perspective on how that game is actually going, even with that handicap, to me, it makes perfect sense why she would give it to Sophie. So unless there's a good reason for her to actively think that Kim should not be giving it to her, then I'm surprised that Sophie is surprised, because coming into the season, it seemed like the two of them had a great rapport and they didn't have like a solid pregame alliance or anything. But if you'd asked me, oh, who are the combinations of people who are likely to work together, Kim and Sophie would have been solidly in the mix for me. And given what seems like is each of their positions in the game, if Kim just gives it to Tyson, which is what Sophie assumed automatically she would do, well, even if Tyson is your closest ally, which was never clear to me, it felt like it was Kim and Amber, and then Tyson was in their alliance too, But then Tyson was trying to get off that sinking ship himself once he realized what was going on. And then Kim also knows that Tyson is someone who, if he ever does have control again, is going to be like double dipping everywhere. And it's going to be so hard to trust Tyson implicitly, because he's going to be one of your biggest threats if he's ever in a spot to actually do something with the idol. So it seems risky on like both ends to give it to Tyson. And then it's unclear if Kim and Tyson, the way the game is playing out, do even trust each other at all. We haven't seen the two of them really converse properly outside of like one conversation in a montage in the first episode. Whereas it seemed like, based on what Yul said in his long manifesto, which sadly CBS has banned him from doing any more of, so that's the last tantalizing glimpse into Yul's thought process we're going to get for now.
I mean, if only he could do tweet threads. What a dream scenario that would be.
Yes. Instead of using Twit longer, like it's 2012. But in that, he said that he and Sophie had agreed that they wanted Kim on board, and that they gave her a heads up about how that boat was going, with the intention of reaching out to her afterwards. So it's like Sophie knows that that's what they were doing, and it seemed to have worked. And now she's surprised that Kim isn't like shunning her entirely to give it to someone else. Like, shouldn't she be happy that that aspect of her plan is going perfectly?
Yeah, and to quickly close the sidebar, it seems insane to just ban Yul. They have essentially just banned him from tweeting any more than 280 characters at a time, but he can still tweet. So it seems like he could still answer some questions. But yeah, to just get to the meat of this issue, I think it's a really interesting spot for Kim, first of all, and a huge piece of it comes down to how she feels about Tyson in particular, who seems like the most likely, based on the TV episodes, to feel like he should have her best interest at heart going forward, just given that they were the two kind of isolated from everyone else. But you certainly have no real idea what that dynamic is like, if a dynamic even has really existed between the two of them for anything longer than like a week. So yeah, in Kim's spot, I agree that I think I would be looking elsewhere in a lot of situations to try to use this other half to pull someone else in that I would hope would be at least open to the possibility of having my best interest at heart going forward. And I think I agree with what you said, that Sophie seems like a really compelling pick to me. I know that they at least have some sort of relationship from off the island. And while I could potentially see others, like Yul comes to mind as someone who would be more inclined in the dark to potentially be willing to work with Kim and trust her long term, because I would think he would have less of an idea of how nervous he should be compared to Sophie, who I'm pretty sure has a clear idea just what Kim Spradlin is capable of. I think Sophie is still a really compelling pick, because she does seem to have a decent amount of influence. And like you, I think they would make really good natural allies, at the very least in the short term. So I know this is something, a decision on Kim's part that has been getting berated because of Sophie's reaction to it in confessional, just kind of making it seem like such a dumb thing to do. But based on what Kim knew at the time, I actually think this would be pretty likely to be the direction I would go myself.
The other thing, too, is that from Sophie's perspective, if she's looking at it from Kim's perspective, who else is she meant to give it to? So let's take Tyson off the board for the moment.
Well, Sophie seemed to make it sound like it should be a no-brainer to give it to Tyson.
Okay, so I'm saying, let's just assume for now, let's take Tyson off the board. So then you can look at the Sandra, Sarah, Tony group, where firstly, each one of those people is highly dangerous, unreliable. You never know what's going on with them. You also don't know if what's going on within their unit, like are the three of them a tight alliance, or like any pair of two of those, you also are going to have some weird dynamic going on. So giving it to any of them seems like that's immediately off the board. Then who else does that leave? So you could give it to like Nick or Wendell, but as far as we know, she has no bond with either of them. And what is giving it to either of them meant to really accomplish, right? Like it's just an unknown quantity at this point. So that only really leaves Yul and Sophie. And if you have this existing rapport with Sophie, and also you think that Yul is more powerful, so you don't really want to embellish that even more, but then also you want to give it to someone who is in control so that they can help you. Sophie seems like the best way to split the difference on that, where you can imagine that, like, if there's a swap or something, it might be easier to pry Sophie away from Yule than vice versa. And then, like, you might also think that Sophie is going to want to be keeping her options open. You know, Kim's a good parachute to have, that to, like, if the boys' club falls apart, you want to have someone else who you can rely on and work with. So even if you think, like, Tyson is number one with the bullet, it seems like Sophie herself is a clear number two. And so if there's any factor at all that maybe she doesn't even know about that would lead Kim to be wary of giving it to Tyson, then it should not come as a shock, I think, that she would give it to Sophie.
It should not come as a shock.
Yeah, it's almost like if Sophie had said nothing, I would be much more at ease with this. But instead, Sophie not understanding it seems to go against what we know of Sophie as being like this very kind of keen, socially aware person who is always thinking about things from other people's perspective, trying to get in their heads, has this very like detached but informed view of the game. And this just seems like a very out of hand dismissal of Kim, who I think has proven that her judgment is something you can trust at this point. So
I think what Sophie is saying, I think Sophie would totally get it if Kim had some other device within the game or some piece of information and she was sharing something important and secret with Sophie because she wanted to build that bond. I think Sophie would totally get why Kim would want to develop that relationship. I think the disconnect, and I think this is understandable, and it's not Kim's fault that this is the case, but this is a situation where she is handing Sophie essentially authority over whether or not her own idol gets used. And Sophie, I think, is merely saying, how could she possibly have the trust in me to give this back to her necessarily? Which I also think is totally fair of Sophie to wonder.
Okay, but the other option is giving it to Tyson, who conceivably, if the next vote could just be an easy split between Tyson and Kim, and there's no way that in that spot, Tyson is going to agree to use his off the idol to protect Kim, thereby voting himself out again, although it's Tyson, so you know, maybe he would. But
I have a third option.
Okay.
If I were in a, and I'm not saying this is the case necessarily for Kim, I am optimistic that she would feel like she has at least a few people that would be open to working with her down the line if things got shaken up a bit. But if it were the case that I were on this tribe, if I'm Kim or anyone who feels like they're on the outs, they get this idol that is split in half. It needs to be given to someone else, and there is no one I can necessarily feel good about to give me the other half back. I don't know if there is anyone I would rather look across the beach and see than my man Tony Vlachos, and see him not making many waves, seems to be at least knowing what the majority is doing. I think if there's anyone who is going to be interested in the prospect of their bag of tricks getting a little heavier, Tony is an extremely compelling candidate. And I know that he's out there on probation, and this is like giving the recovering addict a bag of cocaine to celebrate their 6 months of sobriety. But I feel like if you can dangle that idol in front of Tony Vlachos, some magical things could happen.
You know that I'm here for that from a TV standpoint, but I don't know if it's wise, but that might, I think that's actually a heads up call. But you could see, like, again, though, if you're Sophie, right, the idea of giving it to Tony, however appealing it might be, the risk there is incredibly obvious. So, and I'm willing to believe, too, that there's also stuff, maybe some friction between Kim and Sophie that we're not seeing that informs why Sophie is so confused. But I don't know, to me, that just seemed, it's like, I respect Sophie a lot. I respect Kim a lot. It makes perfect sense for me for them to want to work with each other. So the fact that Sophie is pushing back against that so strongly raises questions to me. And I'm just curious what the answers to those are.
I believe the answer is Sophie is not interested in letting Kim Spradlin go deep in this game.
And I fully respect that, too. Like, yeah. Can't argue with that whatsoever.
I think that checks out to me. I understand why someone would feel that way. What is your take, just overall, on the half-idols? We've seen them in other seasons, but what did you think about one split idol being buried or not even buried, but hidden in trees at each camp, and the regular idols coming in, and other advantages coming in, it seems through Edge of Extinction this time around. Is this a good balance for you?
I do like it on balance for the most part, but I think it's even more appealing in a season like this, where if you know there's going to be a constant stream of idols and advantages and so on raining from the sky, I think it helps to mitigate that if some of those idols have a bigger barrier to entry in terms of use, where like it is not going to be, I can just use an idol at tribal council to buy myself 3 days, and I know that in those 3 days I have decent odds of just finding another idol or being gifted one via Edge of Extinction. If you actually have to work to use it and not just to find it, although you don't really have to work to find it either these days, I think that's a change for the better.
So I feel good about Denise and Adam being able to get on the same page if and when they end up wanting to use that idol. What do you think about the likelihood of Sophie letting Kim play that idol?
I mean, I can't give an answer that doesn't sound like a cop-out, right? It's going to be Sophie's going to weigh out the pros and cons, and she may decide to, like, even if the move makes sense to keep Kim around, why not just let Kim go, right, without getting blood in your hands? Like, if everyone could just sign, like, this mutual pact to have Kim Spratton removed from the game, I think they would all take it, because that is not someone you want to have any leverage whatsoever. So maybe it's just going to be a hard no, and so we can effectively burn her half of the idol right now and be content with that. But maybe she's going to see a chance to make a move with it, or if you know, if there's ever a chance to improve her own position, then she could take it too.
Yeah, I think the number is 4. We have interviewed years and years ago at this point 4 people on this cast, and those people were Adam, Sophie, Kim, and Tony, and 3 of those 4 friends of the podcast got idols this week.
Just saying, people.
Yeah. Come on the podcast, get yourself an idol on Futures. Hey, Kelly Wentworth came on and she got an idol in her next season, and that didn't go great, but use your idols.
Hey, look, we there's no money back guarantee here. Yeah. If you get voted out with the idol in your pocket, that's on you. But we can just we can help you get there. We can be Ben, right? We walked to the Ben could run.
Yeah, we are not just a pro Ben Driebergen podcast. We are the Ben Driebergen of podcasts. Yeah. By the way, closing question here for me on these half idols. Can Denise pair her half with Sophie, or can Kim pair her half with Denise or Adam? Or what do you think about that ruling?
I've been wondering that myself. I also wonder, like, what the exact ruling is in terms of if somebody gets voted out with one half. Does that deactivate the whole thing permanently?
Yes.
Or is there some way for the other? Okay, so the other half can never become live again?
I would imagine that that's got to be the case. And I would also imagine, because the idols had tribe-colored strings on them, like Denise and Adam each got half of an idol that very clearly had a blue string on it, I would guess they cannot be swapped between tribes. And I also think that is a very bad ruling.
I was also going to wonder if this opens the door for some kind of fake idol possibility, where you create a fake half and then you hand off the fake half and then you give the real half to the person who you do want to work with. But then that other person just believes that they have, like, the keys to the kingdom if only you're willing to work with them. So they have to keep you around mm-hmm. to make use of it.
Yeah. So definitely a lot remains to be seen as far as how all of these idols are going to play out. Let's not also forget that Sandra still has her idol that could, realistically, I would imagine, come into play any given week. It would never surprise me for Sandra to feel like making it through this round for sure is a prudent idea. I'm sure she's aware that her name is getting thrown out there pretty regularly, or at least I would imagine. So
also, I can just tell that I'm going to forget completely about Sandra's idol until, like, episode 9 or something, where it's gonna flip the entire game, and probably not in a way that I'm gonna be happy with.
And we're never gonna get any kind of hint that it is coming, because the previously on Survivor still appears to be dead. It is at least on the edge of extinction for another season.
Do we think we're gonna have that maybe intermittently, where if we get to the merge or whatever, maybe that's the perfect time to fill everybody in, or at least a finale, you would hope, right? If you want to recap all the amazing events, hopefully, of the season that that would be the time to do it.
I don't remember for sure. I'm positive the Edge of Extinction finale did not have any kind of previously on Survivor because nothing happened prior to that moment mattered. But did 39?
Well, that is completely wild to me. I don't even remember. I couldn't tell you.
I believe 39 did not have a finale previously on Survivor, although that could be totally wrong. And I would expect that to probably continue all season long here. I would probably need odds on this, but given the right price, I would very happily bet under 0.5 previouslys on Survivor this season.
I think I agree with you, and I hate to see it, or not see it, I guess, as it turns out.
I love
out.
It. I am so happy that we are in the post-previously on era. All right, so let's stay on more advantages here, Dom. The safety without power advantage we're going to see come back into play here. We saw last season on the Island of the Idols, Janet who declined an opportunity?
Sure. Why not?
Yeah, let's go with that. Where safety without power is an advantage that Natalie is going to find in the water well. And a lot of heads up observers out there seem to pick up on that before the big reveal. Shout out to anyone who was on top of that, because I sure was not.
I thought that you were just this was leading up to you making fun of the way I say water well.
No, I love the way you say that. That's one of the good ones, Dom. You can say water well anytime you want. You have like I'm gonna say you pronounce water second only to Philadelphians in my favorite pronunciation of the word water. But Natalie finds this, and I guess we can call it sells it to Jeremy. I guess that is technically what is going on. She gives it to him in exchange for what is, in essence, her own fire token back that she gave to him in the first place. She's kind of like Jinhoing herself here, where she's getting paid back with something that was already hers to begin with. But what do you think about this safety without power twist? I know the first time around we both liked it in theory. Having Jeremy now in control of this, are you anticipating that this is something we're first of all going to see come into play this season, and secondly, any kind of just updated thoughts or a refresher of your thoughts on safety without power?
I can't give a refresher because I forget what my thoughts were at the time, but it seems like of all the twists they could implement, this is one of the more maybe anticlimactic ones, where there's no even suspense of will they play the idol correctly, will they play it at all, how is the vote going to go? Maybe someone else just gets taken out and they're trying to flush something. It's okay. Well, I'm leaving. Bye, guys. See you next week. Which, if that person leaving is a done deal, and so people are like airing dirty laundry at tribal council, or there's like public recriminations, expecting that there's nothing they can do about it, which is just no longer true in the age of so many twists and advantages. And that's maybe one of the subtle downsides of it. Is that you don't get these like public blowouts anymore. You don't get the kind of people at the top of the food chain like getting ahead of themselves and resting on their laurels, because you never can, because there's always something that could be lurking around the corner. So that takes away one of the upsides of this. So I'm not really sure what the point is meant to be. It feels like, but maybe you could do something where like they're exempt from the vote, but they still get to watch at tribal, or there's some like other twist to it where if you use it, then maybe if it's pre-merge, you like swap tribes or something, or something weird happens that really has long-lasting consequences. But as it is, it's just, I don't know, it feels just like a form of immunity that isn't as exciting as an actual immunity is.
Well, I agree. It's generally going to be an anticlimactic result after someone has used, their story is going to be anticlimactic because they're not going to be involved, I guess, in the final result. But I do think under certain circumstances, it could be a really interesting twist within the game, and on a personal level for Jeremy, I would be very excited about having this power, especially in the modern era where there are just so many times where something goes haywire at tribal council. And there are, I'm guessing, going to be plenty of spots where Jeremy would be thinking to himself, I wish I could just pass on this round and just get out of here. I'm fine with giving up my vote to just stay out of the line of fire. So I agree that generally speaking, it's going to be kind of deflating to have all eyes, you know, if it's a situation where it's like Jeremy's under the gun and he uses this to get out of the way, that it will be weird for TV in the moment and then immediately probably result in Jeremy just being back under the gun, potentially to an even more extreme degree. But I also think when someone does use this, it could have pretty huge consequences on the way the vote that night ends up playing out, which is what I think the point is here. If everyone thinks we're going to go in and vote for Jeremy, and if he has an idol, he has an idol, and so be it. But at least we know where our votes are going. That is a pretty, at least in many, many years, unparalleled kind of situation to have someone just removed from consideration in the moment, and all of a sudden a big group has to come up with an entirely new plan.
Okay, but I think that plan is almost always going to be this safe default fallback option where, like, let's say Jeremy goes into tribal and he has immunity, so everybody knows that and everyone has to play around it. So maybe before you wanted to vote out Jeremy, but you know you can't, and so you're spending the afternoon instead coming up with some alternate plan, and that could be an interesting plan. It could be a blindside, it could be something totally out of left field. Versus if Jeremy has an idol, he can spring that on people and take them by surprise, and that's the big payoff of this. And or maybe they're worried about him having an idol, so they play differently, and that leads them to like out-level themselves, or that unknown information adds this interesting element where there's so much you can do with it. This seems to get none of those advantages, where as soon as Jeremy leaves, yeah, that throws them for a loop immediately, but now they still have to vote again, and so what are they going to do? Are they going to come up with some completely new plan in the middle of tribal council, or are they just going to vote off the person who's on the bottom of the food chain because that's the easiest thing to agree on in that setting in the space of 10 minutes?
I'd probably pick off the person on the bottom of the food chain. I agree. It will potentially lead to a less interesting vote, but I think if I were Jeremy, I would probably rather have safety without power than a hidden immunity idol.
Yeah, and I think you would rather have, maybe sometimes you'd rather have safety without power than immunity as well. But I'm saying from our standpoint, it just seems like the outcomes of this in the immediate sense are pretty bad. And so you're hoping for it to have some consequence like the next episode when they get back to camp or something. But even that seems tough to rely on.
Yeah, I guess to just boil it down, I would be a very big fan of having this advantage as a player, although I do think it will potentially be less exciting than the twist, than some of the other twists that we are used to from a viewer perspective.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So one actual closing thought I had on the advantages this week is just kind of a big picture thing. We now see Sandra get that idol in episode 1 or episode 2, depending on how you look at things, and Jeremy here with this safety without power. Jeremy explicitly lays out, actually, the benefit of knowing how these advantages are being entered into the game this season through Edge of Extinction, and no one else knowing that yet, at least not on his tribe, or at least not that he's aware of. I think that is really important, the same way we generally talk about it in terms of like people who find the idols early have a big advantage in finding more idols because they know how they're being hidden that season. This is an even more exaggerated version of that, as far as I'm concerned, to know, and I'm sure many people have suspicions that this is going on, but to know with certainty how all of this is working in terms of exchanging fire tokens for advantages from people on Edge of Extinction, that definitely does seem quite meaningful. And that would be the sort of thing, when I talk about something Kim could hypothetically share with Sophie to build trust, rather than something so meaningful as giving her complete control, essentially, over her idol. If Kim were to find that out and share it with Sophie, I think Sophie would totally understand why she was doing that. It is, I think, a pretty enormous advantage.
Mm-hmm. And that's a spot where everyone else doesn't know how much they don't know yet. Like, so even if, let's say Jeremy was not a direct beneficiary of this, which he definitely is, and he's reaping the rewards so far, even if it was just, I know how this stuff works, that would be a pretty big edge to have. And as you say, a big thing that you could use to help build trust with people.
And even if the answer isn't that big of a deal, like I said, I'm sure many people have their own ideas about the possibility of Edge of Extinction people having some influence over the main game. But just Jeremy sharing that conclusive piece of information with you is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure.
All right. So I guess let's get into like our one camp life scene that we got this week, where we have this red team and their mission to get some breadfruit from the breadfruit trees. Everyone knows what breadfruit is, right? Am I the only one who had never heard of breadfruit before this episode?
I hadn't, and I felt very culturally ignorant for not knowing it. So I'm glad we're all on the same page on that one.
How have we been in Fiji for this long on these exact beaches and never heard anything about breadfruit?
Maybe it only comes out for the all-winter season. You know, they hide it away otherwise, and they're finally bringing out the big guns.
I mean, I guess they didn't have the structural engineers of Yul and Tony out there to retrieve the breadfruit.
It's so high up in the canopy that mere mortals could not hope to possibly bring it down. But I did wonder if this is... Because the way that Yul was talking about it, and maybe this is the way that Yul talks in general, which is, like, all-knowing and also very soothing and comforting at the same time, he talked about it as if, of course, it's just breadfruit. It's the most natural thing in the world. I have breadfruit every day back home, which maybe he does, you know, in his part of California or whatever. But that made me, despite how you're talking just bathes me in a warm glow in general, that did make me question myself. It's like, how have I just never heard of this before?
It's very soothing hearing Yul just talk and explain things, I swear. Loved it. I loved his line about, like, I'm probably going to be burning more calories than I'm hoping to gain, but I can't give up.
Yeah, when Yul writes his presidential memoirs in 16 years, if you know, the Republic is still around by then, I need an audiobook. I'm going to need a proper tape of that.
Yeah, are you here for the Quan Clark ticket in 2024?
Sure, let's do it. I don't know if the building tech dystopia is going to get any better under a Quan administration, but he has the presidential affect to let me ignore that and ignore the issues and focus on the style, and that's all I care for.
Yes. All right. So, Tony is the person I wanted to get into from here. Tony and the Ladder is the scene that I loved so much this week from the camp life. I could not believe that this worked. It looked like it was falling apart even as they were just trying to balance it up against the tree. But one way or another, it seemed like Tony made it several rungs up that ladder. Like, if I were one of the producers, I would have had some major reservations about him going that high up.
Yeah, and honestly, I am impressed with the restraint of, maybe it's just the people I follow, but there have been surprisingly few Chaos as a Ladder jokes this week so far, and I'm honestly very thankful for that. So good work, team. Let's keep that up. Good effort so far.
I mean, that may be our episode title this week. I haven't come up with anything yet.
100%, if nothing else comes to mind. But I did enjoy how this perfectly encapsulates the difference between the two of them, where you'll methodically put together this well-crafted and engineered, like, implement to get the breadfruit down with the bamboo, and then Tony just has this giant ladder where, like, the gaps between the rungs are bigger than most people are, and he just has to, like, vault over, you know, each excessive bar to get his way out the ladder. It was truly a marvelous feat of engineering, which somehow avoided killing him, which, you know, we're never getting Tony 4.0 if Tony 3.0 dies that out there on occasion. So small mercies, I suppose.
Yeah. One thing, being a Survivor Live tweet regular will teach you, is that there is absolutely no such thing as original thought. I saw so many tweets about how the ladder was a metaphor, like, right after that was going down, which is,
everything is a metaphor, Colin.
It's a great observation, but it was so funny to see 18 people have it at the same time. But, yeah, and by the way, next week it looks like Tony is going to be catching a shark, a little Richard Hatch throwback, potentially. So that should be exciting. And overall, Dom, Tony just really looking good to me. We see he and Sarah reconnect this week, the Cops R Us reunion, both of whom seemed genuinely into that, and that seems like something worth keeping an eye on. So overall, I am blown away at how good I am feeling about Tony's spot in the game right now.
I wouldn't go that far.
Like, I am. Are you not buying Tony right now?
It's not that I'm not buying him. It's just that, like, it's weak. It will be week three, and that is still very early days. And I can, you know, maybe Tony has put a lid in it so far, even if that lid is, like, teetering uneasily on the top of the pot or whatever. But that could easily just boil over, and everything could come crashing down for Tony, you know. Week to week, there's no guarantee of safety, right? Not that there ever is going to be on this season, but Tony could bring it on himself in a way that most people are not going to.
I agree with that, but I just mean, you know, it's a shame we didn't do any preseason podcasts about this, Dom, because I'm pretty confident we would be on the record having some concerns about Tony even making it to week three. And in the timelines where he did make it to week three, I would not have felt in general like it would be under circumstances as seemingly good as these. As far as I can tell, it goes back to me again to the idea of just people's approach and a mentality within the game, and Tony really taking a step back, which I did not know if he was even capable of doing, and being deliberate and saying, everyone is going to be super paranoid the minute I leave camp. The number one thing I must do is image control. I need people to feel comfortable and feel like there's nothing up my sleeve and nothing in my bag of tricks. And so far, it really does seem to me like everyone's name is getting thrown out there. It just I cannot believe the lack of concern I have about Tony leaving soon.
They have gone to one tribal council, and if they go to a second, God forbid, and Tony is voted out, we are not going to be in here hopefully saying, I don't know how this could have happened. Everything was going so well for Tony. It's going to be, well, yeah, of course. Like, this is only a matter of time.
No, of course. There's a risk any given week that everyone could, for very understandable reasons, decide now is the time we gun for Tony. As I talked about in last week's podcast, I really don't see how anyone can ever fully trust Tony on this season. But thus far, it seems like he is defying my expectations in that regard. It seems like people do, at least in relative terms, feel all right about Tony, and for the time being, I think that's just about the best you can ask of him. There was no conceivable timeline where people were going to be coming in here dying to have Tony in their alliance because they weren't super worried about what he was up to. Everyone is, of course, always going to be nervous about leaving Tony unattended for too long, but through 7 or 8 days or however far we are in, I feel like Tony just being a background player is almost the best case scenario, better than even being involved in making majority decisions.
The bar is so low for Tony's. It's really sad to see. But no, I mean, I obviously hope for the best for Tony, and I hope that the Brian Scully-esque tweets of Tony Vlahos will not be the X person voted off of Survivor will get to continue for a long, long time. I just would hold off until after, let's say, the second or perhaps even third tribal council before making any of these really bold definitive statements.
Okay. I will feel horrible because I totally agree. It's well within the realm of possibility that we show up this time next week talking about the undoing of Tony Vlahos, apparently. I will feel like a super jinx if that happens, and I apologize in advance because that was entirely my fault.
I love how much you enjoy living on the edge, you know, where you enjoy standing these people who at any moment could bring their own house of cards crashing down on top of them.
Well, let's hope that Tony is not the one living on the edge after the next episode.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yes.
But what do you make of this whole, construction aspect of it, too? Where, like, if you're going to lie about being something, don't say you're a construction worker and then do this. Like, I'm sure there are some amateur construction projects on Kakayan, which gave rise to the lie, so to speak, that he was trying to sell people.
The all-time of that is, I think it was Henry, right, on his initial season of Australian Survivor, pretending to be a yoga instructor and, like, leading the tribe in yoga, and someone had a confessional of, like, this isn't yoga, this is just, like, soccer stretches.
Yeah, it's like at least half of this tribe owns yoga pants. You're not fooling anybody, okay? Do your homework before you go out there.
But I mean, I'm pretty confident people do not think Tony is a construction worker this time around. I think the ruse is over.
Yes, I think that ship has sailed.
Yeah. Well, what did you think, if anything, of this Cops R Us reunion here?
I think it's very tentative. I don't know if the gang is fully back together yet. You know, Sarah expressed these reservations, saying that, like, okay, yeah, we have this 3-season history now, but our second season, Tony was not there for long enough for us to even have a history, right? And then in Cagayan, he was the one who let her blindside, and that was one of the most pivotal moments of the entire season. So it's not like they have this long and storied history of actually working that well together. So it's going to be fun to see how solid that ends up being and which one of them ends up striking first when it comes time to end that.
So I guess the reason I'm optimistic about it is just because I actually rewatched parts of this episode this morning, and for the third time I watched this episode, which I don't even remember the last time I watched an episode 3 times. But in this Cops R Us scene, you know, not to get too deep into the edit zone or whatever, but they both individually in confessional said, if Tony's in, I'm completely in. And Tony said, if Sarah's in, I'm in. I feel good about this. And I have no reason not to believe them. And I felt like it was, at least to me, painted in such a way that we were meant to believe in them.
Okay. I mean, I would love to see Sarah go and then for some alternate cop to enter the, you know, I'm not sure which one is the good cop and which one is the bad cop, actually. I choose to believe that Tony is the good cop. So hopefully a better, more convincing bad cop can enter the picture soon.
I assure you, Tony is the good cop of the two. So let's, I think, Dom, get into the immunity challenge just a little bit. We talked about Rob blowing it on the puzzle earlier, but a couple of minor things along the way here. Jeff really laid into Boston Rob, which took me by surprise. I know, you know, he's certainly not averse to letting people have it when they do a bad job, but he never seemed to consider Boston Rob even a mortal survivor player, as far as I was concerned. So this really took me by surprise.
How do you mean, sorry?
I'm just shocked that he would lay into his best friend and hero like that.
Yeah, maybe it's the kind of thing which you only really do with the people you're close to, but you're just like ribbing them or, you know.
Every woman that has ever done badly in a challenge.
That too, yes. But yeah, as Ethan so kindly pointed out, that dude sucked today. So why not, you know, light a little fire underneath him?
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe that's what he was going for. He was trying to motivate him. I don't know. I just he seemed to be really giving it to him. And then the other
Rob was not carrying his family on his back, literally or metaphorically this time around.
No, neither. Figuratively as well. None of the three. But a couple other things here. I always find it weird when in this case it was Ben. So briefly deviating from being the pro Ben Dreebergen podcast, he ran this whole challenge in his cowboy hat, which people do from time to time. It seems like run challenges in hats or clothing that I would think would be a no-brainer to not wear as you're trying to compete in this. But that was dwarfed pretty immediately by Wendell running this entire challenge with his toothpick, like the most choking hazard possible thing. I couldn't believe they would let him do that.
Yeah, Tony was angling hard to be the first medevac from the season, and Wendell was like, actually, hold up, you know, I want a piece of this too.
I was shocked. He's pushing this cart and banging into things. He's got this giant stick of wood in his mouth.
It's not like the toothpick is a necessary part of his aesthetic either, and it's not like you can see it on TV when he's running quickly either. It's like, I'm not sure what the upside is meant to be here, you know? He doesn't really have a look to uphold, but we are just coming to the end of our Patreon-exclusive Survivor China coverage, and so we've just reached the family visit episode there, where Courtney's dad really is a trendsetter in terms of Survivor challenge fashion, just having to run this challenge with his daughter in, like, his like suit, you know, his belt and shirt and everything, as if he's like delivering a lecture just after this.
Yes, he looks and sounds like a college professor. He's literally British and sounds like an older version of Dom. It's incredible. So the red team, I guess, is going to end up winning this challenge. Wendell is going to make it through without getting medevaced, so that's good. So we're going to go back to Blue Camp and talk about who needs to be leaving here. During the initial time, it seems like Jeremy and Ben were the two names on the table. Jeremy's been on the outs. Ben, I guess, has been sketching people out or whatever. Just generally someone not necessarily worth keeping around as far as Boston Rob and the old schoolers are concerned. And it really doesn't seem like it's until Danny gets a bit paranoid, seemingly unnecessarily, that her own name even starts floating out there. Was this, as far as you could tell, just an all-time unforced error?
Yeah, this was kind of bizarre. It seemed like a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts, where if Danny felt a little paranoid but didn't say anything about it, she would have been fine, and then hopefully would have been a little less paranoid over time. But just the mere act of expressing that paranoia sets off this chain of events which really ends in her demise. And if you listen to Danny tell it, she was never really in good with the Old School Alliance. It's not like they'd been working so closely for, you know, 28 days, and then there was a sudden breach that opened up between them. It was more of, well, I just went along with the group and a group in the early stages of the game, and I never really trusted them, and then the reasons why became apparent pretty quick. So she was saying that, you know, Parvati and her were never really that close, and she never felt included with that central core. So it's not like she's really breaking away from anything. It was just her expressing her natural reservations. And I'm curious what you think about this. In situations like this, how much do you weigh up the unforced self-inflicted error by Danny versus the failure of party management, if you like, on the part of Rob and Parvati, not keeping a firm handle on that?
It's a good question. So first of all, I always have a really difficult time really placing an enormous amount of blame on people when we only really get to see about 5 minutes of what ended up going down. And that is particularly true in the very early episodes of seasons where the stories need to just be so straightforward that Danny's entire arc this week was just explaining why Danny is going to be the name that everyone ends up writing down here. And I am totally open to the possibility that when we end up finding out what really went on here, it was either, a foregone conclusion and Danny was the consensus boot days ahead of time and there wasn't really much unforced error going on here. It was just she was on the outs. She didn't know anyone going in. She didn't hit it off and whatever. Everyone was fine with voting Danny out. And I guess you could call that a social game kind of unforced error, not connecting with people. But I also wouldn't necessarily be blown away if there was a lot more that went on here and Danny did have reasons to be scrambling, and just because of the way it ended up going, this is how they chose to paint it.
We've seen both Rob and Parvati in the past struggling to wrangle some very unreasonable people and keep them in line. Danny does not seem like one of those people to me. She seems like someone who, if you give her the basic kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Reinforcements or
assurances?
Yeah, assurances, validation that she needs, she'll stick with you and she'll be a pretty loyal, dependable alliance member. And it felt like those just weren't really forthcoming. I think that dynamic is different on a regular season where you have such a wide skill gap versus a season like this where everybody kind of knows what the deal is. And it's in a way, it's almost easier to play solid, basic ABC Survivor of just getting a good alliance together and everyone is just trying to keep their heads on straight and not get too paranoid or too crazy. And that's kind of Denise's whole thing, right? Is she's going to find her people and she's going to lay low and just be a very solid, hardworking Survivor player with them. And that's hopefully going to pay dividends for her. It feels like Danny is not a Philip. Danny is not Big Tom. She's not like Russell or even like Danielle, right? I think if you just put the work in with her, then it's probably going to pay off. And my issue with Rob and Parvati is that as amazing as they both are in their own ways at Survivor, I think a shared weakness on the two of them is letting people who aren't obviously in their clique feel good about them and feel good about their ability to work with them going ahead. Like we've seen with Rob, it's usually clear on his seasons who his people are and who his people aren't. And that's part of how he keeps his people in line. It's, okay, we are the group. We're the people on the inside. And now we need to systematically eliminate the people who aren't. And sometimes that means briefly turning on our own. Like Matt Elrod can testify to that twice if he needs to. But usually if you ask anybody in the game, am I in Boston Rob's alliance? Even the ones who aren't too self-aware or aren't paying that much attention could tell you yes or no with decent accuracy, right?
Well, I mean, Boston Rob designs his entire game around the concept of us versus them, and I would say... On two of Parvati's three seasons, the political lines were just so abundantly clear that, of course, you would know if you were with her or you were against her. And on Micronesia, it is, at least post-merge, I mean, just a graveyard of people who thought they were down with Parvati getting blindsided by Parvati.
Yeah, just to finish the Boston Rob thought quickly. So usually the element of subterfuge, if you like, that goes on with his game is you have six people in the alliance and every single one of them thinks that they're in that number two or number three seat alongside Boston Rob. And that's how he keeps them all in line, is that everyone is playing towards that end game and it's only going to work out for a few of them. And then for Parvati, everyone wants to be in her clique because she's just that good socially. And I mentioned before that it's harder for her to be like the cool kid that everyone either wants to be or wants to be with on a season like this, where it's just an older group and now she is part of that older group, and it's a more even playing field. But also, just in general, like that is her game. It's, if you're not with us, I'm going to come across often as very remote and snobbish and cliquish, and I'm not going to, you know, even pretend that I have the time of day for you. However, if you work yourself into my good graces, then you get the attention and the validation that you've always wanted from people like me, and specifically here from me. So it's, you know, for Danny, who is like teetering on the edge of that and who isn't clear about her position, it's, I don't know how effective Parvati is at like reaching out and actually making sure things are okay and not needing to be the center of attention for a change, and just letting that dynamic go to the other person instead.
Well, so I, when talking about not really wanting to kill Danny for, you know, rake her over the coals for potentially just playing entirely her own way out here in the span of an hour, like they made it seem on TV, like I do want to give the benefit of the doubt that it was nothing like it went, like it looked on the episode, but I kind of stopped short of the conclusions to the questions that you asked about who I'm deducting points from there. I have a really tough time, as I said, feeling like I know a ton about what necessarily went wrong for Danny. If it is the way that, you know, if it really did go down the way that it looked like on TV and it was a completely unforced error, and maybe that's exactly what we're going to find out afterwards, then I'm totally willing to feel like we have spent many years potentially overrating Danny as a great survivor mind. But in terms of Boston Rob and Parvati, and them kind of letting go potentially of someone who would have been loyal to them, maybe it's results oriented to say that, like, hey, they got a unanimous vote regardless. It seems like they have plenty of people from whom to choose to be loyal. But even if it wasn't necessarily that straightforward, I would still be really reluctant to be deducting points from them in this kind of situation where they are playing with such big targets on their backs that I think being willing early on to go with what other people want to do is just fine, as long as they feel good enough about their chances of, at this point, I would say, just making it to the swap. This is such a different game than it was a decade ago, where you really have to be mapping out your long-term alliance from the beginning. If anything, I would say that is actively a fool's errand most of the time, and they are really just playing to make the swap.
I hear you, but like, let's say we come in here in maybe 2 or 3 episodes time and some new majority has come together against Rob or against Parvati, it feels like Danny is a piece who maybe could have been on their side and who would not have been immediately inclined to flip the game around on her if she felt comfortable. Now, maybe Danny going after Rob in the first episode just doomed that from the outset, and this was only a matter of time to where there would be some kind of friction between them. But if anything, it was almost like Danny went to Rob with her concerns about Parvati, right? She trusted Rob more than she trusted Parv. So right now you have Jeremy, who is on the outs and who seems like, you know, advantages aside, he would be dead to rights if they just wanted to target him. And then on the other side, you have Adam and Denise, who came under a lot of heat early on, but are slowly seeming like they're fitting into the group. And then you have Ben, who's this wild card in the middle. In theory, all of these people, and Michelle as well, in theory, all of these people could gang together against the two of them. And maybe voting out an old schooler helps to prevent that from happening, right? Insofar as, like, now it's 3 people instead of 4. It seems like much less of a threat.
Genius.
But it also could be, well, Adam reaches out to Jeremy, they put their differences aside and are just like, hey, now the old schoolers are turning on themselves. This is the time to strike. This is the time for us to take control of the group and get out this this alliance, which a lot of people are saying preseason is going to run the entire game.
I know this is not a conclusion anyone would realistically come to pre-merge, but there are definitely times where the best thing that can happen to you is having your medium majority become a small majority. Like the all-time example of this for me is the Tokenshin's merge. The best thing Steven and JT and Taj could have ever hoped for was Joe getting medevaced or voted out. No question about it. And I know Steven has said that same thing himself, that was without a doubt so crucial in letting the Timbiras let their guard down about a potential Jalapau takeover. And then, of course, what it leads to is a Jalapau takeover.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Not a consideration, I would say, pre-merge, but a good kind of spin zone, I guess, if you want to pitch it that way, that, hey, kind of some 4D chess, I guess, reducing the overall target on a hypothetical old school alliance. The real way to strengthen the alliance is to vote someone out from the alliance, Dom. Everyone knows that. All right, so Tribal Council, I thought, was very interesting here for one reason in particular. There's been a lot of discussion about this. What did you think, Dom, of, I think for the first time in history, or at least the first time we've seen it on TV, we'd theorized about this potentially being like the logical extreme of people going through others' belongings back at camp, but Boston Rob leads the way for everyone to dump their bags out to find out who has the idol. What'd you think about that?
It's an interesting move for someone who wants to avoid the target and doesn't want to seem like he's in charge of anything, right?
I think it's a terrible move. Interesting is the wrong word.
I also don't know what the upside really is, because you see Denise and Adam were both able to effectively hide their hearts of the idol. So there's a chance that this actually gets you bad information if this is what you're going for, where, yeah, maybe someone didn't see this coming and they dumped their bag out and, oh, look, there's some like giant hunk of wood with a string on it. What's that, everyone? Let's take a closer look. But there's also a chance that someone just has it hidden in their pocket or something. And, okay, they dump out their bag and then you don't see anything. And are you meant to read anything into that? Are you going to be able to avoid reading anything into that? It just seems like, and I don't think Robert's doing it to gain information necessarily. Maybe it was just like a strong arming tactic. But yeah, this was I can understand, you would expect this to be in the Boston Rob playbook, but this seems like a bad time to bust that one out.
Yeah, this is an all-time story checks out that Rob is the one to break this barrier down. And it would have been so funny, now that you mentioned like someone with a giant idol, if this had happened in Ghost Island and Dominic Abate had his little like Ziploc pouch in his bag with 2 idols and a fake idol tucked away discreetly, and Wendell had to dump out Eric Reichenbach's necklace from his bag, it'd be so unfair. But yeah, I chimed in there when you said this would be interesting, if you were Boston Rob, to kind of be such an overt, almost dictator, I would say, again. And that would, I would imagine, be something people would be worried about being the case in being in an alliance with Boston Rob, is being just yet another person in his 100-plus-day career who is just either required to bend to his will or be voted out. I think this is a pretty horrible idea. And generally speaking, you know, I've talked for many, many years at this point about Boston Rob and this style just being so, I would say, like, so obviously bad. Like, you, the last place you want to be this early or pretty much any time before, like, day 35 in a game of Survivor is the obvious leader. I feel like taking this kind of initiative, you can describe it as taking initiative if you want to spin it positively, taking this kind of initiative and, you know, trying to sell it as, hey, this is in everyone's best interest other than the people whose spots are about to get blown up, for us to have as much information as possible going forward here, it really just stands out to me as, like, so overtly aggressive. And propping yourself up to this extent is going to get you voted out of Survivor by the end of it pretty close to 100% of the time in any season that is not explicitly designed for you to succeed, which, for, you know, thankfully for Boston Rob, he has had working in his favor before. But it is crazy to me that we can watch this kind of behavior over and over and over and consider this good and talk about Boston Rob like this all-time Survivor genius and have entire seasons themed around him being the guy who's solved the game.
Yeah, in Rob's partial defense, I guess, I think you have to play the game that you yourself are well suited to and that you know, and an all-star season where you're playing against almost guaranteed to be the toughest competition that you or anyone on that season has ever played with, I don't think that's a time to try for a new play style that you're not accustomed to and which surely at least one other person on the season can do a lot better than you can.
Boston Rob has been successful on Survivor because Jeff Probst loves him.
Would you say that about Survivor All-Stars?
I mean, yeah, I think that's why the Survivor All-Stars is pretty much the absolute best case scenario for Boston Rob until he's on, like, his third or fourth try with a ton of help from production.
Okay, I could kind of see that. The issue is, though, is Rob going to be any more successful playing just like some in-between middling game where no one really knows where he stands? Like, I don't think he has the flexibility in his game to be able to do that. And honestly,
and that to me is just a mark against Boston Rob as he's surviving. It's not that difficult.
Yeah, of course it's a mark against him. I think, though, that very few people actually have that flexibility, and part of why I sometimes give maybe disproportionate praise to, like, Sarah's winning game or some other games is that I felt like they displayed a surprising and rare level of flexibility that's pretty hard to replicate. But what I would say is that for Rob, he only is effective, I think, when he has that aura of, like, invincibility and momentum behind him. And we saw in Heroes vs. Villains, I felt like he did a poor job with, like, I thought he was doing a great job up until the point where Tyson voted himself out and then, like, by proxy voted Rob out. And after that, he did a poor job, I thought, at, like, getting Jerry back into the fold or making a good pitch to her. It was almost like the moment that he's not in control, he loses all control. He doesn't even have any semblance of it anymore. So I think for him, the only way that he can do well is to just hit the ground running, play as aggressively, as proactively as he can, and challenge everyone to get on board or get out of his way. Because, yeah, there are four or five people on this tribe who, if they teamed up, could easily kneecap Rob's alliance. But are they going to team up? Are they actually going to come together? It feels so much easier to just get behind Rob and take the easy vote. And the moment that he loses that fear that surrounds him, he's done. And there's no regaining that, I think, once you've lost it.
I mean, we talk about playing to make the swap. I'm positive. I said in some preseason podcast we did, if I started on Boston Rob's tribe, I'm pretty confident I would just line up behind him and say, yeah, let's go. Let's just all make the swap and feel good about each other. So I think that is totally viable. And I also want to add, if we just cut this one scene out of him essentially, as far as I'm concerned, demanding that the tribe all empty their bags out, I would still feel extremely good about the game Boston Rob has been playing to this point. I have been very impressed with everything other than this, and I guess his performance on the puzzle. He is doing, up until this point, I would have said, a much better job of keeping at least a lower profile as best he can, and I would believe in him to be able to proceed in the game without immediately painting this enormous target on himself. But seeing this happen, seeing him go into this mode at Tribal Council really leaves me concerned. I think this is just such an obviously bad thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I guess, what did you think of Adam kind of standing up for the other side, saying, people look for idols, it's part of the game, let them do it? Was there any sense in him saying that as far as you were concerned, or is that a spot where you just stay quiet and hope the idol doesn't make itself visible?
I think he's speaking for the group, and I think there's something to be said too for someone just gently chiding while pushing back against him, just to show everyone else that it is actually possible, right? And that we don't all just have to fall in line, and that we can hope for something better.
Yeah, one random thought I had about Adam over the course of this episode, and just as a player in general, I'm a big believer that Adam being pretty just kind of blunt about the dynamics within the game works really well for him. And I think that style is going to be particularly effective against really good Survivor players. I think a cast full of worse players would feel like he's like bossing them around, when what he's doing is just talking about the game in pretty straightforward terms for people who are game literate. And I really want to put it on the record that I feel like the more skilled his opponents are, this will sound weird, but I feel like Adam's style benefits immensely from playing against people who really are there to win themselves and understand the game well themselves, versus I think he'd have a much rougher time playing against like a Redemption Island cast.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I guess closing up thoughts on this episode, Dom, we just rewatched on the aforementioned patron exclusive feed, which you can find over at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Before we did China, we did Guatemala, aka Guatemala. And we have recently seen Danny's winning game all over again, and we're really interested in seeing how a second shot might shed some light on all of, you know, everything that we didn't really get to see along the way there the first time around. How does this performance impact Danny's legacy for you, Dom? Because, you know, she was someone, as I mentioned, you took with the number 4 overall pick in our all-time 38-way winner draft.
This season never happened. You know, anyone can have a bad day at the office. It's water under the bridge, Colin. Nothing to write home about.
Well, to clarify, I don't mean to suggest that you ranked her as the number 4 greatest winner of all time. You just thought she had the 4th best chance of winning this season, and I didn't disagree very strongly with that in the moment. She was always someone I probably put it in these exact terms. I always thought of as, at the very least, not going to make unforced errors, and that goes a long way in Survivor. So maybe offering some counter evidence, I guess, if that's a word or a concept, some evidence to the contrary here, that maybe all was not as it was necessarily cracked up to be. I don't think we were alone in feeling really good about Danny as just a Survivor player in general. And I do want to reiterate that I do not believe that going out 3rd here necessarily invalidates all the good stuff that we did see from her first time around, or that she couldn't be a really successful Survivor player under different circumstances, because just based on what I've seen from her collective body of work, I would still feel pretty good about Danny Boatwright, at the very least, compared to an average Survivor player, without question. But she was someone that I remember flagging up as being one of the higher likelihood candidates for me to come out here and look a lot different. And it definitely does seem like that is what happened.
Yeah, I can co-sign all of that. And it may be that Danny would still have the chops to take on another, you know, all-star season with a weaker cast or a season of regular players. But in this, you know, biggest of all possible Survivor stages, she just came up short.
Right. I believe Danny was rumored to have been in the mix for Game Changers. And if she had gone out there and been one of the lower profile winners and made it through and gone on a deep run and looked pretty good there, I don't think anyone would have been surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as a closing note, I remember 10 months ago, probably at this point, at some point, when we were either doing a preseason podcast for this or one of the Guatemala episodes, talking about how Danny Boatwright might willingly trade being the literal first one out for Patrick Mahomes to stay healthy for the next 15 to 20 years. Dom, an update on that story for you and the other sports ball tweeters on Super Bowl night. The Kansas City Chiefs are now the reigning champions of the NFL. Patrick Mahomes is the Super Bowl MVP, and I believe he is 24 years old today. So I still feel like this was overall a pretty good year for Danny as far as she was concerned.
She'll take the good with the bad, for sure.
And still in the mix. Hey, who's to say Danny won't be the next Chris Underwood, leaving the game third overall and coming back to shock the world on finale night? You know, the Chiefs actually, along the way, in all three of their playoff games, were down double-digit points right off the bat, and then, which is a lot in football, and then ended up coming back to win all of them, obviously. So maybe this is exactly where Danny wants to be. I guess closing note here, Danny wills her fire token to Denise, which kind of surprised me, although I don't know who I would have expected her to give it to. Any thoughts on that?
I guess maybe they just had, not an alliance necessarily, but just a connection. They have a mutual respect for each other. And I guess if you're not, you don't have an old school alliance anymore and you don't have a good bond with anyone else, then Denise seems like a good person to root for, to be in that corner.
Sure. I'm on board with that. And then I guess actually last note from me here, this time around, it is Adam who is looking underneath the paperweight that holds down the parchment as people cast their votes. Last week, both Ben and Rob were spotted searching around the voting area for some sort of clues or idols. I know in both Survivor South Africa and Survivor AU, yes, recently on Survivor AU, there have been idols hidden at Tribal Council. I don't recall if that's ever happened in America. I don't think it has, but it seems like people are ready for that to be a thing, and I will be 0% surprised if that is a thing this season, and that's why they're showing all of this.
I'm honestly shocked that we haven't seen this on American Survivor yet, and it's been so long, and it's such an obvious thing to at least try out that I can only think that they have some hard and fast rule against, like, violating the sanctity of Tribal Council or something like that, because otherwise I don't know how you get to fire tokens and idol nullifiers and having God knows how many idols in each and every season, and you never get to, hey, why don't we just put an idol at Tribal one time and see what happens?
I think what they don't want to see happen is it becomes a thing they do once, and then from that point forward, no one will start Tribal Council until everyone has had a look around to make sure there's nothing nearby. And I do, I don't know how this memory just got triggered, but at some point, years and years and years ago, I remember joking about what they should do is Jeff's necklace should be the idol, and someone has to go up and take it from him, and that's the idol that they play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. Dom loves that idea, too. So there we go on episode 2 or episode 3. I'm calling it episode 2, and hopefully we can come to some sort of clearer consensus on that by the time next week rolls around. We will hit the edit zone in just a second. Before we do that, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. You can email us, domandcolin@gmail.com. And as mentioned earlier, bonus episodes just about done now with China over at patreon.com/domandcolin. And now we are going to talk in a bit more detail about the editing, which not everyone seems to love so much. So if you want to tune out before that, this would be the time to do so. Dom, anything else before the edit zone?
I just want to give a nod to our good buddy Sandra for really crushing that puzzle in the challenge today. Her first real breakthrough in a challenge in how many challenges has she played now? Someone needs to do the numbers on that.
Oh, I don't know. I do know she had sat out of 12 challenges. And a quick update on something we discussed, I think it was on this podcast and not in the patron zone. We did get a final number here on the number of tribal councils Parvati has been to, which was a debated topic last week. It turns out the answer is 28, I guess, is the final number. And that, I assume, is votes, the individual tribal councils where she voted someone out and not final tribal council. So it would be 30, I guess, probably with final tribal council included. But regardless, for anyone who cared about that from last week, which is no one, that is your answer, Dom.
I will say, to get from the actual figure to the like mid-40s that you were suggesting, Parvati would have to play again and probably reach the finals in order to even come close to being that figure.
Well, so the math that I was doing is she went to at least six or seven post-merge tribal councils every single season she played, and it just turned out, I mean, she just won a ton of pre-merge immunities that I didn't factor in. The 30 to 40 range, which was my final range, was barely off and would not have been wrong for someone who has generally played that many days of Survivor.
Okay, if you say so.
Yes, I do say so. So, Dom, with that out of the way, let's hit the edit zone.
You are listening to the Dom and Colin Edit Zone.
Mike Holloway,
Michelle Ken,
Brad Culpepper, Rob and Sandra.
You are listening to the Dom and Colin
Edit Zone.
What are you doing?
Tune out now.
All right, back in the Edit Zone. Dom, who stood out to you this week?
I don't know who really stood out to me this week. I thought a lot of people who were kind of in the spotlight in episode one had a quieter episode this time around, so your, for instance, breadfruit genius aside, kind of taking the week off, and a lot of people from that group who, now that they're not going to tribal council, and it was kind of refreshing to see in that first episode. A lot of the time, I think, in seasons like this, we've had the same tribe just going to back-to-back tribals. It's nice that we got to see both of them go, not just to see what the dynamics are, but so that everyone has a chance to like say their piece and be featured in the episode to some degree. So that tribe obviously taking a back seat. The one exception to that kind of was Sophie, who was naturally going to be in the spotlight a little bit more because she is being handed that idol by Kim and needs a chance to reflect on that. But everything she had to say, as always with Sophie, was seemed, you get a clear sense of who she is, what she's doing, what she thinks about the game. And based on Kim's like trajectory so far, I can see us being there to believe that, like, oh yeah, of course Sophie was right, and Kim was foolish for considering giving it the idol. There was no like pushback against that in the episode yet.
Yeah, I believe that we were meant to agree with Sophie there.
Yeah, so if we are meant to agree with Sophie, and we're seeing a lot of Sophie, and the things that Sophie is doing are objectively smart, then maybe we should just put Sophie at the top of our list.
The big winners for me this week, I would say, were Sophie for sure. Adam, I thought, other than not being able to find his hole for his torch at the vote, which was pretty funny.
That was great, by the way. And to me, those are often like my favorite scenes of the episode. Is that was great. The breadfruit saga with Yule and Tony was great. And there was a good secret scene this week too of Parvati having to like teach Ethan to lie in Survivor and him just not really be able to do it properly. So it's stuff like that to me. Like, I get that in a season of All Winners, like, the strategy is going to be taken to a new extreme, and so you need to feature that. But a lot of these are some of the all-time great characters, too, and so just seeing them interact at all is fun. But seeing these cute little moments as well, it just makes the episodes that much better. So I hope we continue to have a good balance there.
Yeah, sorry, I totally agree with that for sure. This is, I love these, as I've described them before, these little, like, micro scenes, these little, like, 8 to 15 second hilarious little moments. I think add a ton to episodes. So Sophie, Adam, and then the other big winner, dare I say it, Dom, Tony, I thought looked really good again this week. We're seeing a lot from his perspective. He seems to be having a good understanding, I guess, of what's going on around him and the way that he is perceived, and he's, you know, making every attempt at not getting on the radar. We're hearing a lot about his, like, long-term kind of ideas. We're seeing him bond with Sarah, and he's hilarious around camp. I feel like Tony, I will not be talked out of at least getting to spend at least a couple of weeks believing in Tony. Let me have this, Dom.
I want to believe, but I'm not going to believe. I don't want to cause that pain to myself.
How about Parvati? Is she someone who registered anything meaningful for you this week?
No, if she had, I imagine it would kind of be negative, though, where, like, we don't see Parvati, like, alienating Danny, but we also don't see her responding to that in a way that, like, instills you with any confidence about her going forward, I think.
I continue to believe in Parvati's chances. Nothing really stood out this week. I was, in the case of Parvati, really just looking to see if she got just confessionals. I don't care what they're about or what she's saying, just is she staying visible? And she was, to an adequate degree, for my liking this week. So she continues to be at least relatively near the top for me. Ewell kind of in that same mix of, as long as he's staying visible, I will continue to feel good about him. And then I would also say, you know, if Adam was a big winner for me, Denise, I also thought, continues to stay at the very least in the mix. There were a couple instances, I would say, of her specifically, like, wanting to give the idol to Parvati, where she was potentially made to look kind of bad, but I don't think that's the end of the world at all. And I would imagine Denise continues to be someone that the average fan is really rooting for, which I think is important.
How do you feel about Boston Rob? Can I interest you in that at all?
Yeah, I was, you know what, you can interest me. I'll dabble in a little Rob hypothetical winner discussion. It is certainly not at the point for me where I'm going to be, like, done chaining him anytime soon. It's going to be, I would say, pretty close to impossible to feel great about Rob's chances of staying, of mitigating his threat level, I suppose. That's, like, my fundamental issue with Boston Rob, especially in a cast this smart and forward-thinking, that anyone, let alone a majority of people, are going to be interested in being Boston Rob's lackeys this time just seems pretty preposterous to me. So I think he's got to play a much different style. And up until that everyone drop your bags part, I thought he was doing a good job of that. And I do, again, expect him to go back to generally erring on that side of things. So you can still interest me a little bit. We can have a little Boston Rob as a treat.
Okay, so how explicitly are you tying that to the edit, though? Because are we, as the viewer, meant to think, well, Rob is going to have to either bring his A game, and that A game is the same game he's always played, or is it, this is, you know, this is Winners, or in an Australian accent, this is All Stars. We're going to have to bring something new to the table, and is Rob doing that effectively?
Did you just do an Australian accent?
No. Although, somehow we skipped over this in the premiere. Can we talk about Jeff's British accent from the first episode?
Rate it for me. How was it?
Well, I thought it was an Australian accent, so I would give it a low rating, but maybe other people have more discerning ears.
So I knew that he was doing something. I didn't know what it was from, and I probably would have guessed, like, Scottish. It seemed a little Bravehearty to me.
Okay. I could get behind
Is it
that.
Bravehearty? Is it, what's it from? I don't even know what it's from.
Are you just saying the only Scottish thing that you recognize, or?
I know that Braveheart could easily be confused, you know, Scotland could easily be confused with people doing a British accent, and I'm now wondering if I've stumbled upon the actual thing it is referencing.
I see, that was my first thought too, but apparently that's not a line from the movie. I did wonder if this was meant to be an impression of Mark Burnett, but who actually is going to make that connection? Who's watching?
Yeah, to be clear, I've never seen Braveheart. I know roughly what it is about, and I know that it's Mel Gibson, but that is the... I don't know any quotes other than, they can take something, but they can't take our freedom? Something. There's something to that effect in Braveheart. This is not a good tangent for 2+ hours into a podcast, I would guess, Dom. But let's see who else has been looking good here. Are you a believer at all in Jeremy? Is he making an impression on you?
I would expect a little more from him reflecting on like his closest ally being blindsided last week, just given their prior connection. But it felt like so much of that revolved around Nat that, you know, I would expect to see more Jeremy in that picture if he was going to rebound from this in dramatic fashion and go on to win the season.
I thought he got enough when with the whole safety without power thing and talking about how it was from Natalie. I feel like I would still be having Jeremy with some at least above average winner equity at this point. I guess to check in with our Queen Stays Queen segment, where are you and Sandra? Any shot here, Dom?
Well, I don't know where Sandra is, which brings me down a little bit on her because we just didn't get much Sandra in this episode.
So I guess this week it's the Queen Stays Queen segment, question mark?
Maybe, although bearing in mind, we have seen Sandra win a season where she got no confessionals for I think it was 6 straight episodes. So that's no reason to count her out, apparently.
Yeah, very good point. How about someone I know a lot of people were high on after the premiere, and I continue to be a believer. Where are you on Tyson?
Would you say that Tyson had a quiet week as well?
He got a little in the latter segment, but nothing else jumps out to me. But I mean, the people, Tyson and Parvati, and then obviously Rob and Amber in particular, stood out. And I'm sure other people got to talk about their families as well. But Tyson getting to talk an extended confessional about his family in the premiere is going to leave him on my radar until further notice.
Honestly, this is a fine week to take off.
Yes.
And I'm not going to dock anyone a lot of points, really, from not being featured this week, unless it's someone who was in the thick of things with the vote and just somehow didn't get anything. So, like, if, you know, Rob or Parvati was completely silent somehow, or, you know, someone who was really in the action on that tribe, if they don't get to say their piece, that's more of a concern. But if it's I don't have Wendell that high on my list, but like the fact that Wendell was quiet this episode is not some like great mark against him, for instance.
For sure. And actually, one thing I meant to say when we were talking about Rob that I feel like is worth bringing up, just the idea of what a Boston Rob winner edit would look like on this season. I think he would be the pretty clear number one with a bullet for me to get a reasonable amount of content or an unreasonable amount of content pretty much no matter what, at least as long as he is in the main game. So I'm going to have, I would imagine, a harder time picking up on a Boston Rob winner edit than I would for most other people. Like, to me, as we said last week, the fact that Sophie is getting this much is a huge deal as far as I'm concerned, given that it is Sophie. Whereas I feel like Boston Rob, you know, she's not someone they, I don't think, would ever say to themselves, we need to go out of our way to highlight this person. But the fact that she's still constantly being highlighted, I think, is a big deal. Whereas Rob is kind of the opposite of that, where it would take something really over the top, like Redemption Island-esque, for me to feel like, oh, Rob's got this in the bag. Because I feel like he's someone they would for sure feature no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess another person potentially worth getting into quickly, if she can find her way out of this sticky situation here, how about Kim Spradlin? Are you feeling like she has some paths to overcome?
Yeah, maybe. It's just as she flagged up herself, we don't know what Kim being on the bottom possibly looks like. So it's hard to evaluate, does this look better or worse than it could be, given her situation, because we just don't know. We've never seen that situation before.
Yeah, I will never be ruling Kim out, especially with a swap just kind of implicitly looming at every point until it happens. Like, then we could have a swap coming after the next vote until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your girl Sarah Lucina in the mix for you?
I guess she's not out of the mix fully, but nothing really inspiring nothing notable.
Yeah, just a guy. I am believing in Cops Are Us, so that would be a pro for her. We did not see too much in the way of Michelle or Nick or Wendell or Ethan. Anyone else I'm missing here that had anything worth getting into in the edit zone?
Is Michelle on your radar at all?
She was in enough of the premiere that she will remain on my radar, but I am unfortunately feeling like at this hour it is with a below average amount of win equity, although as we just talked about, if there were a time to take an episode or two off, it is exactly this point in the game.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so I think that will do it. Dom, anything else from you this week?
I'm good. I just wanted to say that I'm loving the season so far, and I hope that I'm sure it will kind of like settle into a routine or a pace after a while, but I still have that like starry-eyed vision every time I just watch a clip from this episode of being amazed at these people even on my screen together. So I hope that lasts for as long as it can.
I am completely on board with that. I guess I am just now looking at it, and we are just now hitting 2 hours, but still, yeah, I don't think we even hit 2 hours last week. So with a double episode last week, we still managed to talk more about this 40 minutes than the season premiere. So this should be a really fun season all the way along. One more time, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. Patreon.com/DomandColin for bonus episodes. And Dom, anything else? Are you trying to get in here one more time?
I'm all out.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought I could hear you in my ear saying something, so that must have sounded really weird on the playback because nothing was actually being said. But that will wrap us up this week in a really coherent manner, as always. Thanks for tuning in. Take care, everybody.